You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. Coming up, Camp Randall Stadium turns 100 years old this year. We'll talk with UW legend Pat Richter about his favorite moments in the stadium.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Public hearings on the proposed state budget kicked off this week, and education funding was a major concern for citizens who attended a session at the University of Wisconsin-Platteville campus.
And speaking of education, State Superintendent Tony Evers easily won another term this week, but he wasn't the only big winner on the ballot. A majority of referendums on school spending were supported by voters to the tune of $700 million. We'll find out more about what voters could be getting for their money.
We'll also find out about a trade dispute that has major implications for Wisconsin farmers. And we'll also talk about who Milwaukee County voters elected to sit on the judicial bench there. Robert Menser joins us now, as he does just about every Friday, to look at the week's top news. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Hey, Rob.
Hi, Judith.
Good to talk with you.
Hey, it's good to be back.
So let's start with the agriculture story. We learned this week that dozens of Wisconsin dairy farmers are scrambling to find buyers for their milk due to a trade dispute with Canada. So what's going on there, Rob?
Trade disputes are very hot right now as President Trump meets with Chinese officials, but you don't expect your trade disputes to come from Canada, but this one does. So, the details of this are arcane, as trade disputes tend to be, but basically Canada has decided to add a bunch of fees to imports of a particular specialized dairy product called ultra-filtered milk, which is used to make cheese. Canada had been importing it duty-free, and now they're slapping additional fees. Canada's view, of course, is that they are acting within current trade rules, that the rules weren't being enforced before, and they're just trying to protect Canadian farmers. But this is serious business to Wisconsin dairy farmers. This in itself is not a new dispute. This didn't just begin happening. But what happened this week was the large supplier, Grassland Dairy Products of Greenwood, which is a big buyer of Wisconsin milk, told about 75 farms that as of May 1st, if nothing changes, Greenwood will no longer buy their milk. Right now there is an oversupply of milk in the market, so a lot of these farms are really at risk of shutting down. There are not a lot of buyers out there, and so they're put in a very tough spot.
So they're told on, it sounds like, pretty short notice, we might not be buying your milk anymore. It's a market that is already glutted with milk products. So what options might there be for these farmers?
Well, this is something that has been going on. Governor Scott Walker has written letters to President Barack Obama and now to President Donald Trump about this issue. The one hope among dairy groups and advocates is that the U.S. government will, reach some sort of agreement with Canada, perhaps to lower these fees. The price of milk has been low. This is the flip side of there being an oversupply. And so milk already in a lot of cases is below profitable levels for Wisconsin farmers. Normally, these things should sort of be a bit cyclical. But of course, that's easy to say if it's not your family's business that is at risk of closing.
Well, let's move on to the first public hearings on the proposed state budget that took place this week. The first was at the University of Wisconsin-Platteville, and citizens there really wanted to sound off on education funding. What specifically are they concerned about?
So the state legislators look like they're set to increase funding for K-12 education, and this was a major topic at this hearing. Platteville also is of course a university town. There's a University of Wisconsin campus there, and so that was another issue. And it's The K-12 issue is part of this larger, longer-term discussion, and that, you mentioned in the intro, the other thing that happened this week was voters approved 40 out of 65 local referendums about $700 million in local funding for schools. It's notable because the state legislature has limited the amount that school districts can increase taxes without going to referendum. Mm-hmm. And so the response, what has happened is there's been a large boom in these referendum votes, and most of them pass.
And is that surprising that in a time when people are, at least politicians say that people want, lower taxes and they don't want to pay into the infrastructure as much? Is it surprising that so many Wisconsin residents said, yes, we are willing to pony up extra for our local schools?
Yeah, it's a bit surprising, and it's just a bit of it feels a bit like a shell game in a sense, right? In a certain way of looking at it, what has happened on the state level, where there have been large cuts to K-12 in previous budget cycles, it puts a pressure on the locals. Some local officials will argue that it's the same thing as going on with transportation, when state aid to local governments is cut, then they're going to increase local taxes to fix potholes or whatever. And so it could say that it sort of wipes out, property tax decreases or other tax cuts that have been made on the state level for a lot of people. But of course, it's also a vote. It's a democracy. People, if the schools can organize and make the case that that's a good investment of taxpayer dollars, then the public will support it. Maybe just one thing to say, I saw the Verona area school district in suburban Madison passed a record referendum worth $181.3 million, and that got a lot of attention. But that's a growing district. Mm-hmm. That's in an affluent area. But the other thing that is we've seen a lot of, up here in north central Wisconsin, there was a Tomahawk referendum. There was Rochelt schools in Portage County, where they're really those referendums really are about basic operations costs. They're about keeping the lights on, and that doesn't seem like the way it ought to work.
As we wrap up on education, State Superintendent Tony Evers just won his third election as state superintendent, and with the largest margin to date for him. What might we expect from him as priorities as he starts this third term overseeing education in Wisconsin?
Well, Evers, my favorite thing about this story, Evers was called by the Wisconsin State Journal on election night. He was at his home playing euchre with his family. and he said, oh, I won. Oh, terrific. He is more on the liberal end of the political spectrum, though it's a nonpartisan office. And he has called for completely revamping the state's funding formula for K-12 schools. And, that is a heavy lift. There has been very little appetite among legislators to do that because it's just hard. It's just complicated and hard to do. There's bound to be winners and losers. But that's his perspective, is that the way that the state funds schools is inequitable.
We're talking with Robert Menser right now. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. We're taking our weekly look at the biggest news stories in the state. And so, Rob, another election note of interest is who Milwaukee County voters elected to sit on the judicial bench. Tell us what happened there.
Yes, in Oak Creek, the nation's second Hmong American judge was elected. Kashua Yang is also the first female Hmong judge in the country. She's 36, and like a lot of Hmong people, she came to the U.S. as a refugee from Laos. She was 6 years old when she immigrated, and her campaign. She told that story, sort of a classic immigrant story, American immigrant story. She worked her way through college and eventually went on to law school and practiced mostly sort of family law. And it's significant. This is a kind of a cool story and a significant story of for the Hmong community.
And Rob, you are in the Wausau area, and there was the tragedy, the mass shooting earlier in the month, or possibly late last month. Can you tell us how your community is processing that and recovering?
Sure. Yeah, so it's of course it's a long process. I mean, four people killed, including a police officer. The shooter himself died as well. And so there's a lot of grief and trauma. This week there was the last of four funerals of the shooting victims was held last night in the Wausau area. There was also a public event hosted by local police departments to sort of build as a community healing event, and the idea was to give people a somewhat of a broader perspective on what the traumas folks see. I think it's going to go on for some time more, but certainly we are, you know, as a community, is starting to begin the healing process.
And as a member of the media in that community, how have you been kind of weighing the best service that you can provide to a community that's hurting?
Well, so in the early hours, the first couple of days following the shootings, really the hunger and the best service that we could provide was reliable information, right? Everyone wanted to know what is going on, and so we reported as best we could what we knew for sure without getting ahead of ourselves as rumors fly. But very shortly after that, we set about to talk to loved ones, write profiles of the people who were lost, and try to understand them as people, and invite those who cared about them to share. That's of everything that we've done. That might be the thing that I'm proudest of, the way that we, but also just the community itself has memorialized, has honored those victims.
Well, and certainly not to turn to something totally light and frivolous, but of course life goes on. And Rob, I understand there's actually a pretty cool new exhibit that's coming to your neck of the woods that involves some prehistoric creatures and dinosaurs. What's that?
Yes, thank you, Judith. This is my 5-year-old son's top story of the week, maybe longer. The downtown mall in Wausau is getting this a dinosaur exhibit. It's going to open next month, and we wrote about this. And this is cool because, you know, dinosaurs. but the other thing, just an observation, Wausau Center Mall, like a lot of downtown malls or malls in smaller cities, has had struggles. There's, you know, retail outlets across the country are closing. Just in the past year, there's been a children's museum, sort of a play space open there, a museum exhibit of Hmong history, and now this dinosaur exhibit. Hmm. I don't know if it's going to stick, or I don't know if this is like a direction for the future, but as a way to deal with empty space in former retail spaces, it seems like a good trade to me.
So maybe we need to have your 5-year-old come on and give us a review next week.
Consider it done.
All right. Well, Rob, thanks so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you.
Rob Menser is a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. He joins us just about every week at this time to recap the top state news stories of the week.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we look into last night's airstrikes on a Syrian military base that were ordered by President Trump. But right now, we want to invite you to call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're wondering what's on your spring playlist, or maybe you have a spring break trip coming up. What are you going to be playing to keep you going on that drive? We want to know what you're listening to. 800-642-1234.
And now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
To sell its phonographic cabinets, a Grafton furniture business decided to start a record label. It became one of the leading producers of blues records in the 1920s and made pioneering recordings of some of the nation's great musicians. Sergio Gonzalez tells us the story of Paramount Records as part of Wisconsin 101.
The first time we heard about this was because Jack White's production company had just put out this huge collection of Paramount records. And so the first thing I heard was not the blues music. It was some of this quote-unquote ethnic music of Southern and Eastern European. The first time I heard it, I was like, this is not good. What is this? Like, why would people listen to this? You know, it didn't sound like anything special or particular, and it wasn't until you get to the blues that you really understood what made Paramount special. It was strictly a money-making project. So the Wisconsin Chair Company was founded in the 1880s, and they were really successful in Port Washington creating things like beds and cabinets. But with the introduction of phonographs in the late 19th and early 20th century, they decided to jump into that business, and they were making phonographic cabinets for corporations like the Edison Company. And they got to thinking, well, if we're making these phonographic cabinets, why don't we just start making some music as well? So they had purchased two different subsidiaries that had kind of ventured into the blues market, so Puritan Records and the New York Recording Laboratories. And really the thing that pushed them into the blues market was the hiring of J. Mayo Williams. He was a guy who was living in Chicago, and he had actually contacted this company and asked if he could be a talent recruiter for them. And he had a very special talent of finding unknown artists in the South and then bringing up to Chicago and eventually all the way up to Wisconsin to record music. So some of the big recorders, you had Louis Armstrong, Jelly Roll Morton, Ethel Waters, and Ma Rainey. But the big find for J. Mayo Williams is Blind Lemon Jefferson. The Grafton plant was made specifically to make cheap music. Artists would come all the way up from the South, stop in Grafton, and then because of the sundown laws in Grafton, would have to leave the city as African-American artists and head back to Milwaukee to find a place to stay. Paramount blew up in the 1920s, up until basically the Great Depression, where the entire music industry collapsed. At its height, the Wisconsin Chair Company employed 1/6 of all workers in Ozaukee County. And so they were a touchstone organization within the community. And so I would imagine a lot of people understood that company kind of being instrumental to, you know, their family's well-being. Like a lot of companies, Paramount Records did not treat their talent with a lot of respect, and specifically their black artists. They were paid considerably less than the rest of their artists on their slates. And so records show that 9 out of 10 Paramount recording artists never received any royalties from their music, and a lot of them were swindled out of the copyrights on their songs. And so they would write these fantastic songs, and Paramount would hold the rights to them, and the artists would never see really any profit off of that. Paramount records to this day are really hard to find because they were produced on these cheap wax masters that were made for immediate production but not made to last very long. And so people who purchased Paramount records knew that they were going to get great music but not very good quality. I think the amazing story about Paramount is that we're talking about one of the most important companies in the creation of blues music in the 1920s and early 1930s. And it was based here in Wisconsin, in a place that people wouldn't even think about.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik. Get this
black steak soon. And this is Central Time, and we want to know, what is on your spring playlist? What are you listening to right now in the change of seasons? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or post your playlist on the Central Time Facebook page.
And let's go to the calls right now with Al in Kenosha up first. Al, what are you listening to?
The Mountain Goats.
What are or who are the Mountain Goats?
Who is it?
Okay.
It's John Darnielle, and he has a somewhat changing band roster list. There are a few regulars. A song I would suggest is Going to Wisconsin. He's been called the most literate songwriter. I don't know if it was of the century or of the decade or which one of those it was, but he's got great music.
Hmm.
And even going to Wisconsin, their state gets its own song.
Nice. Well, thanks for that, Al, and we'll have to look that up.
Yeah. Let's go to Zeta now in West Allis. Hi, Zeta.
Hi.
What's your favorite song for the spring? What are you listening to?
I am going to put on my list War, What Is It Good For? Absolutely nothing.
So there are a couple versions of that, aren't there?
Did you say the star?
Edwin
Starr. That's it. The name of it's War.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, Zeta. And you can let us know what you are listening to right now when you can start driving with the windows open because it's warming up. What's upbeat? What feels summery? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And I'll say one of the things I'm listening to is Pink Martini's new album. They were just here in Madison. We got to talk with them on the show. I got to go to the concert.
Ooh.
It was really great. And it's called, the album is called Je Dis Oui, which means I say yes. So I am saying yes to upbeat, fun, kind of world lounge music. For me, it's a great soundtrack for the spring. Kate, what about you?
I'm listening to a range of things, but basically I'm trying to learn about Wisconsin music.
Oh.
So I've been searching more for Wisconsin music, and we have Chris Molina joining us here in the studio. Producer Chris Molina, you have some new music in your collection.
Yeah, new music might be a little bit of an exaggeration.
New to you music?
New to me music. Yeah, there was a big record sale here in Madison recently. I think a private donor donated his collection to a chain of thrift stores around here, somewhere in the range of like 20,000 albums.
It was amazing.
Yeah, so my girlfriend was there the other day and managed to pick up a 4-record set of Lawrence Welk's greatest hits. And we are both fans of the show, and you can say what you will
about
that.
Chris, how have I not known this about you in the years, literally years we've worked together?
I don't know. I guess I don't talk about my love of accordion music all that often, but it should come up more.
I'm trying to learn the accordion. Let's not get ahead of ourselves here. But yes, I love accordion music.
So if you need an accompaniment, we've got the record.
Well,
we've got
we're neighbors. I mean, we could have a party based around that box set.
We need to have a bubble party.
Well, because it's spring. They wouldn't even freeze or anything.
Absolutely.
Now.
So can't listen to that one in the car because it is vinyl record.
That's awesome.
But we are looking forward
to
it.
So you have a turntable?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's kind of impressive.
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to that this weekend.
And Kate, I'm guessing with little ones in the house, you probably have some favorites.
Yeah, Lisa Loeb. She's a great musician and does a lot of great kids' music now. So we try to make it hip.
Well, there you go. Yeah. Well, you are listening to Central Time. Stay tuned. We are going to talk about the airstrikes in Syria. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up after 7 on Ken Rudin's Political Junkie, Ken's guests navigate through all the tornadoes swirling around the Trump White House, and a biographer explains why President James K. Polk may be the most successful one-termer in the nation's history. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, the United States launched 59 Tomahawk missiles as part of an airstrike in Syria last night. The strike was ordered by President Donald Trump after Syrian forces launched a chemical weapons attack on civilians earlier this week.
The move marks a significant change in the United States' approach to the ongoing conflict in Syria and could mark a new chapter in U.S. foreign relations, particularly with Russia.
Nora Bensahel joins us now to talk about this development and what it could mean for the U.S. moving forward. She's a distinguished scholar in residence at American University. Nora, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So let's establish something right up front because there might be some confusion. There are U.S. troops currently in Syria, but they've been there for a while in the fight against ISIS, correct?
That's right. They've been there to help some of the rebel forces that are countering ISIS and other terrorist groups, but the U.S. has not been involved in any way in Syria that has been explicitly designed to affect the regime of Bashar al-Assad.
And this airstrike last night was against a military base that is controlled by the Assad government.
Yes, that's right. And it is in response to the chemical weapons attack that we saw earlier in the week. U.S. officials had what they believed was convincing evidence that the that chemical weapons attack originated or was at least in part supported by aircraft based at that airbase.
And here's President Trump's announcement last night.
Tonight I ordered a targeted military strike on the airfield in Syria from where the chemical attack was launched. It is in this vital national security interest of the United States to prevent and deter the spread and use of deadly chemical weapons. There can be no dispute that Syria used banned chemical weapons, violated its obligations under the Chemical Weapons Convention, and ignored the urging of the UN Security Council. Years of previous attempts at changing Assad's behavior have all failed, and failed very dramatically.
So, Nora, what do you think this airstrike demonstrates as far as where the U.S. is on this event?
Well, I'm not sure we know yet. I mean, the parameters of this airstrike were very carefully restricted. It is, was just limited to one airbase. All 59 Tomahawk missiles that were launched attacked this one base, nothing outside of it. And it remains to be seen whether this is a one-off, a retaliation just for using chemical weapons, or whether this signals a broader shift in U.S. policy. It's not at all clear yet from what the president has said which one of those two it will be.
And tell us a little bit about those Tomahawk missiles. What kind of capacity do they have?
They're very powerful missiles. They're launched from warships, from destroyers that were based in the eastern Mediterranean, and they're very accurate. They are precision-guided, so they are very good at hitting exactly what they were intended to hit. The United States has used these missiles in conflicts before. If you remember, President Clinton in 1998 launched some strikes against Iraq for having not let the nuclear weapons inspectors into the country. Those were also Tomahawk missiles, for example. That was a 3 or 4 day limited strike.
And there were 59 Tomahawks launched last night. What kind of price tag do those come with?
They are not cheap. They are very expensive. If cost were the only concern, there would have been a consideration of flying manned aircraft in, because they also drop precision weapons but are much less expensive. But, of course, that's not the only consideration. The Syrians have a very strong air defense network that would put any manned aircraft at risk, and that's why almost certainly the military strike options involved these Tomahawk missiles instead of manned aircraft, where pilots could be in jeopardy.
So, Nora, Russia is a close ally of Bashar al-Assad's, and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson will be visiting Russia next week. Now, Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev said the action last night was, quote, one step away from clashing with the Russian military. So what are the potential risks of this action in light of U.S.-Russian relations?
Well, there's some narrow risks in the military sense, and then there's what it means more broadly. In the very narrow sense, what Medvedev said was right. There were Russian personnel who operate out of that base that are helping Syrian forces, not necessarily complicit in this particular chemical weapons attack, but they are based there. The United States and Russia, for a number of years, have had what's known as a deconfliction agreement, that when they put their airplanes up in Syrian airspace, they talk to each other to prevent any sort of accident or jets flying into each other if they don't know, that a Russian airplane is in the air or an American airplane is in the air, for example. And so one of the things that Russia has done in reaction to the U.S. strikes last night is to suspend that agreement. So there no longer is sharing of information about how Russian aircraft are operating in the air and U.S. aircraft are operating in the air. That contains some element of danger. If they do not know that the planes from the other country are in the air, the potential for some sort of accident goes up. And, of course, how that would escalate is very difficult to predict, even if it were purely an accident. The broader question it raises about U.S.-Russian relations, however, really has to do with the kind of relationship that Russia may have believed it was going to have with President Trump, someone who is, you know, seen as praising Vladimir Putin repeatedly throughout the campaign and in the early days of his presidency as well. This action is directly against Russia's interests in Syria. The Russians have made that very clear in their reaction. And so, you know, there may be a recalculation in Russia about what, you know, they may be able to get out of a President Trump and how he will react in ways that may or may not be in their interest in the future.
And Nora, I've seen that the Russians have been floating a theory that Assad did not use chemical weapons against Syrian civilians earlier in the week. Instead, they're saying that government forces hit a rebel-held facility that held the components of chemical weapons and that the impact set those chemical weapons off. Does that theory hold water?
It's really hard to see how that could possibly be. The airbase where these strikes seem to have originated from are in government-controlled territory, and they are known to contain some stores of sarin. H.R. McMaster, who is the National Security Advisor, made clear in his statement last night that they were very deliberate in what they targeted on the airbase where those Tomahawk missiles were launched, because they do believe that there are still stores of sarin on that airbase in government-held territory, and they didn't want to accidentally disperse those stores.
Nora Bensahel is with us now. She's a distinguished scholar in residence at the School of International Service at American University. And she's with us to talk about the airstrikes carried out last night against the Assad regime in Syria by the U.S. military.
And you can join the conversation. What reaction do you have to President Trump's decision to conduct airstrikes in Syria? Do you think the U.S. should be involved in the Syrian civil war? What questions do you have about this decision? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue this conversation here on Central Time after this short break.
This is Central Time. I'm Kay Darcher Kent.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing our conversation about the airstrikes conducted by the U.S. military last night in Syria, following the Syrian government's use of chemical weapons against their own civilians earlier this week. And we're speaking with Nora Bensahel. She's a distinguished scholar in residence at the School of International Service at American University.
And we'd like to hear from you. What do you think about the decision to conduct airstrikes? This retaliatory strike on behalf of Syrian civilians comes while President Trump's travel and immigration ban is held up in court. Do you think that this new position of the president's should move him to loosen the restrictions on Syrian refugees that he has been pursuing? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
So, Nora, do we know if President Trump reached out to other countries in advance about taking this military action?
I believe there were a couple of other countries that were notified that we were going to do this, although it was made very clear that the U.S. did not wish to have any allied participation. I believe the British were among them that volunteered assistance and were told that, you know, that the United States would be conducting this as a unilateral military operation.
And you did mention earlier, Nora, that there had been Russian personnel at this particular base, but my understanding is that the U.S. let Russia know 90 minutes before the strike so they could actually get their people out.
That's right. And what it probably also did was tipped off the Syrians that the strike was coming, because it's almost guaranteed that the Russians would have let the Syrians know about that. That's not necessarily a, you know, didn't necessarily undermine the military purpose of the operation. The purpose was to help deter future usage and to destroy some of the capabilities that were used in those attacks.
And do you think that members of Congress were caught off guard by this action?
Well, I think many people were caught off guard by action because it is a direct about face from a very consistent principle and position that Trump has held since long before he was president, which is that we should not be intervening in the Syrian civil war and taking sides in, you know, whether Bashar al-Assad stays in power. He was very critical of President Obama in 2013 when he was thinking about launching airstrikes against in retaliation for a chemical weapons attack then. As we know, President Obama decided not to do that, but Trump came out very strongly against it. You know, Trump campaigned on a much less internationalist view of U.S. foreign policy, saying we should prioritize actions at home and not get involved in the world's problems. And even within the past few days, had said that the policy of the United States would no longer be to seek regime change in Syria. That had been the policy of the Obama administration, although they had not taken any military action to pursue that objective. It was still the stated policy of the United States. And so this direct about-face is a remarkable change in a very short period of time as a response to the chemical weapons attack. And for that reason, I think many in Congress, as well as many Americans, may have been surprised by this action.
Let's go to our callers now, and Peter in Madison is up first. Hi, Peter.
Hi. I want to say I think Trump's doing this for political purposes, and I hope that this is just he's doing it for political purposes and there's not ultimately going to be some prolonged war where the United States intervenes in Syria the same way we did in Libya and the same way we did in Iraq. I saw this interview where Assad was being interviewed back in 2006 by Kristi Amanpour. And basically, even back then, she asked the question, basically the United States government has wanted to have regime change in Syria since at least 2006. I hope that Trump doesn't continue with this policy.
All right. Thanks for that call, Peter. And Nora, the U.S. officials are saying that this is a one and done military action. But how much do you believe that?
Well, there's really no way of knowing at this point, right, whether this is embedded in a larger strategy that the United States may pursue now about not just Syria, but about the Middle East more broadly, because Syria does not stand on its own. It's very tied to Russia. It's very tied to Iran. So, you know, decisions about Syria have regional implications, too. But we just don't know. It is entirely possible that this is the extent of what the U.S. reaction will be, and that if Assad doesn't use chemical weapons again, we will not take any further military action. But because this was such a dramatic change in what the Trump administration had said it would do as recently as last week, I think it's really too soon to know exactly what's going to happen next. Although, you know, as Peter said in his call, a lot of Americans who voted for Trump did so in part because they opposed what the United States had been doing in terms of getting involved in major military activities abroad. If the president does want to change his strategy, that is a political issue that he will certainly have to contend with.
We're talking about last night's U.S. airstrikes on a military base in Syria in retaliation for a chemical attack by the Assad government on civilians earlier this week. You can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And, Nora, let's go back to our callers, and Lauren in Burlington is up. Hi, Lauren.
Hi. I wanted to mention, I used to be quite the dove and very much peacenik and everything, and as I've gotten older, I've realized that there's a lot more into play, and sometimes just wanting peaceful negotiations doesn't always happen, depending on who you're having those negotiations with. I voted for Trump. I've been a lifelong Democrat. I actually switched, and the reason I switched is because our foreign policy in the last few years has really put us at a disadvantage when trying to deal with the world's activities. Russia has just basically run roughshod over us, and we've almost kind of become a laughing stock. So part of the reason that I voted for Trump, and basically the main reason that I voted for him, was because I knew he was going to be tough. And last night, showed exactly, even though it was a reverse from what he said he was going to do, I think when showing the grave images that we saw with the infants and everybody else, innocent people being taken out by such horrible action, I think he did the right thing. And I think it's going to give us a little bit of strength now with North Korea, with Russia, with all of the other countries that we have precarious relations with. And I'll take whatever comment off the air.
All right. Thank you so much for calling, Lauren. So, Nora, is this maybe a shot over the bow to warn other countries who may be thinking about getting into conflicts with the U.S. Over third-party places in the world that, you know, there's a new sheriff in town?
It's hard to see this particular airstrike as evidence of that. I mean, you know, as Lauren said, you know, President Trump did run on a platform of being strong, although he did not approve of, you know, did not support intervening around the world. But again, because this was such an about face from what he had previously said, I don't think that this was just designed to send a signal to other countries we may be dealing with. The issue North Korea and elsewhere are very considerable, and even though this does project a U.S. image of strength, it was in response to what essentially a humanitarian issue and a global norm, which are not the types of things that the president had talked about enforcing previously. So it may make some of our other potential adversaries, North Korea and so on, rethink how to approach the United States. I think it's difficult to argue that this was something that the president had staked a reputation on. It was challenged, and he had to be strong in response.
The United Nations was meeting today about the airstrikes. What came out of that?
I think that, you know, there wasn't a whole lot concrete that came out of it as far as I'm aware, but, you know, anytime anything like this happens, and certainly with questions about what will happen next, the UN Security Council gets involved. It's a site for deliberations. You know, it's a place for great powers that disagree to air their frustrations, so I'm sure the Russians had quite something to say at the Security Council today since they were dramatically opposed to this. But I'm not aware of anything that was concrete or agreed that will come out of this, again, because we don't know if this is a one-off strike. It seems to be so far, but we don't know if it's going to involve a broader shift of U.S. policy or not.
Let's go back to the phones and Laura in Manitowoc. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I just want to express that I'm really surprised to hear anybody say that they're surprised at this action. I don't think it's in my imagination that Trump has been very clear about his posturing of being, you know, zero tolerance. He's not going to take anything from anybody. He specifically said that when it comes time for him to take military action, he's going to do it. There's not going to be any deliberation, not any consultation. He's just going to go off and do it. And that's exactly what he did in this case.
Thanks for that call, Laura. So, Nora, do you see this as kind of the Trump MO for going after problems?
Well, he certainly acted swiftly and decisively on this. But again, this was not something that he had staked any position out. I mean, you know, the caller said, you know, that when he said he was going to take military action, he would do it swiftly and decisively. The real surprise here is that he decided to do it in response to this, because it does not directly affect the territory of the United States, which was one of the criteria he laid out as a candidate. And it is about essentially enforcing a global norm, that is the global norm against the use of, that prohibits the use of chemical weapons, as in the Chemical Weapons Treaty. Again, as a candidate, Trump ran against the U.S. role in enforcing global norms and was seen as you know, someone who was going to depart from the traditions that the United States has really held since the end of World War II in enforcing those norms. And yet his first major military action, aside from some continued strikes against terrorists, this, you know, rather large military strike yesterday was done exactly for those things, and I think that's why it's surprising. I don't think anybody's surprised that having made the decision to act, he would do so swiftly and decisively. And the usual standard procedures of how military options are presented to the president and so on seem to be very consistent with what previous administrations have done. But I think it's the decision to react to this particular incident, as horrific as those images were, really does go against many things that he campaigned against and he had talked about. And that's the part where I think a lot of surprise has come in.
As we mentioned, Nora, part of the reason we already have a presence in Syria is because of ISIS. Briefly, do you see this as something that ISIS might try to capitalize on?
Well, I think this action actually makes it much harder for us to coordinate against ISIS. One of the things that, again, that Trump had said on the campaign trail and in the early days was that his top global priority was to defeat ISIS, and that he was going to work with Bashar al-Assad to coordinate to do that, that the common interest with Assad over defeating ISIS trumped the other issues about, regime change and the civil war. So this may actually complicate our ability to go after ISIS, at least for those elements that would have, where some amount of coordination with the Syrian regime may have proved effective.
Well, Nora, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Nora Bensahel is a distinguished scholar in residence at the School of International Service at American University. She joined us to talk about the U.S. airstrikes that were conducted last night in Syria and what the military actions could mean for U.S. foreign relations. You can continue the conversation about this over on the Central Time Facebook page. We'd love to hear what you think.